Welcome, everyone, to the Federal News Update for Wednesday, September 10th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson, and I'm thrilled to be your guide as we try to cut through the noise of federal activity from the last 48 hours.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, here to help us truly connect the dots on this incredibly packed federal landscape. We'll try and uncover not just what happened, but what it really means for you.
Okay, let's unpack this then. In the last 48 hours, that's September 9th and 10th, 2025, the U.S. federal government has been operating at, well, a dizzying pace. We've seen a potent, almost dual-tracked focus, a domestically-oriented push for, you know, populist health care reform and some pretty aggressive economic deregulation. And that's running in parallel with high-stakes diplomatic and national security engagements spanning the Indo-Pacific all the way to West Africa. It's a lot to process, and honestly, some of these actions seem to be pulling in completely different directions.
Yeah, what's truly fascinating here is how these seemingly disparate actions collectively paint a really complex picture. You've got an administration actively pursuing a, well, disruptive domestic agenda while simultaneously navigating an increasingly fraught international environment. An environment, we should note, where its own policies often create friction with strategic allies, even as it seeks to shore up other partnerships. That's complicated. So we're going to dive deep into each significant action, meticulously exploring its immediate impact, its broader implications, and helping you understand the undercurrents shaping tomorrow's world.
Think of this as your shortcut to understanding the complex interplay of policy, economics, and geopolitics that shaped these two critical days. Our mission is simple: to give you a thorough, comprehensive, and exhaustive report in granular detail on each and every action and activity of the U.S. federal government since the beginning of September 9th, 2025. We'll thoroughly discuss the impact and implications of each of those activities so you can walk away not just informed, but hopefully truly well-versed. Right, let's jump straight into the domestic side then. Well, White House launched a major initiative here, one with significant populist appeal. We're talking about the Make America Healthy Again, or MAA, initiative, and its, well, aggressive focus on pharmaceutical advertising.
This is a bold move, definitely. It signals a clear shift in how this administration intends to regulate the pharmaceutical industry and, I think by extension, influence public health narratives.
So on September 9th, President Donald J. Trump issued a presidential memorandum. It went to both the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, and the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. The core directive was to address what the administration termed misleading direct-to-consumer prescription drug advertisements. Now, these are the ads you see constantly, right? On TV, in magazines, online, promoting specific medications directly to the public. The president mandated increased transparency and accuracy, specifically demanding more comprehensive information regarding the risks and side effects associated with these advertised drugs.
And this wasn't just a suggestion. It immediately triggered a significant policy reversal. HHS and the FDA announced major reforms compelling drug companies to include full safety disclosures in their direct-to-consumer ads. What's crucial here, and this is really key for you to grasp, is that this effectively reverts to a much stricter regulatory standard that was in place before 1997. Before that year, the FDA required advertisers to dedicate a significant chunk of their ads, often 30 seconds or more, solely to risk information. You remember those fast-talking voiceovers at the end?
Oh, yeah, listing endless side effects.
Exactly. The 1997 shift allowed for more concise, often disclaimer-based disclosures, which critics argue just opened the floodgates for more persuasive, less balanced advertising. So this new directive is a deliberate rollback of decades of policy. It puts the onus much more heavily on drug companies to ensure consumers are fully aware of potential dangers, not just the benefits.
And the messaging around this was anything but subtle. It felt almost like a declaration of war on the pharmaceutical industry's marketing arm. HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. stated very directly, and I'm quoting him here, "Pharmaceutical ads hooked this country on prescription drugs." He then pledged to shut down that pipeline of deception. Strong words.
Very strong. And FDA Commissioner Marty Menchery, MD, MPH, echoed that sentiment,
right,
criticizing past FDA leniency for permitting misleading drug advertisements, distorting the doctor-patient relationship.
Hmm.
So these aren't just technical adjustments. This policy change isn't a standalone event either.
Right. It's part of a broader administration theme of promoting what they call radical transparency in healthcare. We've seen this before, haven't we? With things like hospital price disclosure initiatives.
Exactly. The language is incredibly strong, suggesting a fundamental reevaluation of the relationship between public health, corporate speech, and regulatory oversight. And this move has clear populist appeal, doesn't it? It taps into public skepticism about big pharma and the perceived over-medication of the country. So for you as a consumer, the promise is clearer, more balanced information, potentially leading to more informed conversations with your doctor. Hopefully.
But for the pharmaceutical industry?
Well, for them, it represents a significant increase in regulatory burden and a potential hit to their marketing strategies, which have become incredibly sophisticated and, frankly, very effective since 1997. It's a direct challenge to how they operate, forcing them to reevaluate how they communicate with the public, with potential implications for their bottom line. Big implications.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting, because this wasn't just a standalone executive order or a simple agency announcement. This felt much bigger. This was a highly coordinated, multi-branch campaign designed, it seems, to create maximum impact and reinforce a singular narrative.
Absolutely. Spot on. The executive action on drug advertising was perfectly synchronized with a simultaneous House hearing held on September 9th. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee held a hearing titled Better Meals, Fewer Pills, Making Our Children Healthy Again.
That shared branding again, Make America Healthy Again.
Exactly. That branding, coupled with the parallel focus on overmedication and unhealthy lifestyles, created a powerful, unified narrative that just amplifies the administration's message. It's a textbook example of leveraging all the levers of government.
So let me see if I get this right. On one hand, the White House's presidential memorandum on drug ads offered a tangible policy solution, more transparency, right?
Right.
And on the other, the congressional hearing, which notably featured testimony from senior HHS and USDA officials, effectively served to publicly define and maybe dramatize the problem. The problem being an over-medicated and unhealthy populace, often linking it to diets high in ultra-processed foods.
Precisely. This combined effort across both the executive and legislative branches was meticulously designed to amplify a single populist message. It creates the impression of a powerful, unified movement against the perceived influence of the pharmaceutical and processed food industries. For you, it frames the issue not just as a health concern, but as a systemic problem that the government is actively and aggressively working to rectify.
What's also notable for you listening is that the final policy, the actual memorandum, represents a pragmatic political compromise. It kind of illustrates the internal dynamics of policymaking, doesn't it?
It does. News analysis points out that simply mandating fuller disclosures falls short of Secretary Kennedy's pre-appointment pledge for an outright ban on pharmaceutical ads on television. That kind of ban would have faced immense legal and industry challenges related to commercial free speech. Huge First Amendment issues there.
So administration officials, in defending the memorandum, described it as the strongest, boldest action we can take, while also confirming that no additional steps planned toward a complete ban were forthcoming.
Which suggests an internal administration debate was likely resolved with this compromise. It allows the administration to claim a significant victory for consumer transparency, a widely popular political goal, while sidestepping the far more complex legal and political battles a complete ban on commercial speech would have triggered. It's a strategic win, really, consolidating public support without overextending their legal reach.
And they're not just issuing the order and walking away. The administration is signaling aggressive enforcement. They seem determined to follow through.
Yeah, they're talking about not just traditional media, but active monitoring of non-traditional advertising methods, too. This includes potentially hundreds of cease and desist letters and a specific targeting of social media influencer campaigns, where proper disclosures, you know, the paid promotion or ad disclaimers, are often lacking or kind of obscured.
That really shows the breadth of their intent, doesn't it? Policing pharmaceutical messaging across all platforms, recognizing how much advertising has shifted online. Okay, so we've seen how the administration is pushing for this radical transparency in healthcare, but that's just one facet of its domestic agenda. What's truly intriguing is how, almost simultaneously, it's taking seemingly contradictory steps in how it approaches fiscal oversight. It presents this fascinating duality we need to unpack.
This is where we see the administration's philosophical approach to governance really come into focus, I think. One part, deregulation to stimulate the economy. Another part, enhanced state control for fiscal integrity. It's a delicate balance with significant implications for everyone.
Let's start with a major deregulatory proposal aimed at federal contractors. On September 10th, the White House Office of Management and Budgets Cost Accounting Standards Board, the CAS Board, published two proposed rules. These rules aim to eliminate over 60 unnecessary and redundant accounting requirements for federal contractors. That's a lot of rules.
It is. And this is a central part of what the administration is calling a revolutionary fair overhaul. referencing the massive, often criticized 2,000-page federal acquisition regulation. The stated goal here is to significantly reduce the administrative and financial burden on contractors. For years, these companies, particularly those that also serve commercial clients, have often been forced to maintain basically two sets of overlapping books.
One for commercial accounting under GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, and another specifically for government contracts under the highly prescriptive cost accounting standards, or CAS.
Right. And this duplication isn't just about extra paperwork. It means dedicated personnel, specialized software, internal audits. It all adds substantial overhead. The administration believes this complexity stifles innovation and discourages, and I quote, talented companies from working with the government, especially maybe smaller, more agile tech firms that just shy away from the bureaucratic maze.
And the most significant proposed change here is to dramatically raise the CAS applicability threshold. Currently, it kicks in at contracts worth $2 million. They want to raise that dramatically to $35 million.
That's a huge jump. OMB estimates this move alone would exempt a full half of all currently covered entities from these strict CAS requirements.
Now, for you as a taxpayer, the thinking is that while it removes a layer of detailed accounting from many smaller players, it still keeps eyes on about 90% of the federal contract dollars by maintaining oversight on the largest contracts. So, oversight on the big money remains.
That's the argument. The administration's pitch is clear. They want to open the floodgates for more businesses, especially those nimble, innovative, smaller ones, to engage with the government, free them from a compliance burden that many felt was disproportionate to their contract size and stifled competition.
Now, if that sounds like less government oversight, prepare for the flip side, because on the very same day, September 10th, we saw an action that expanded government capabilities and, arguably, its reach into financial data.
That's right. The Department of the Treasury finalized a four-year waiver of computer matching agreement requirements for its Do Not Pay initiative. This waiver, authorized under the Payment Integrity Information Act and President Trump's Executive Order 14249, is specifically designed to, quote, reduce barriers to data access for preventing fraud and improper payments.
What this means in practice is pretty significant, isn't it? Federal agencies will be able to more easily and rapidly cross-reference their databases to verify payment eligibility without having to execute the formal, often time-consuming computer matching agreements typically required under the Privacy Act of 1974.
Exactly. Those agreements are usually mandated to ensure proper safeguards for personal information are in place when different government databases are linked. So essentially, this streamlines the government's ability to monitor who's receiving federal funds and for what purpose. The aim is to catch fraud more efficiently by removing a layer of administrative red tape that was originally intended to protect privacy.
This really does raise an important question for you, our listener.
Yeah.
How do we reconcile these two seemingly contradictory actions?
It's a key question. On one hand, you have the CAS reform, which clearly reduces government oversight and compliance burdens on the private sector. The aim is broadening the industrial base, encouraging more companies to work with the government. On the other hand, the Do Not Pay waiver expands the government's internal surveillance capabilities, weakening certain privacy protections in the name of efficiency and fraud detection.
It's a fascinating philosophical tension, isn't it? You could say one action reduces government scrutiny of its corporate partners, aiming for a more agile economy.
While the other increases the government's ability to scrutinize individuals and entities receiving federal funds, aiming for greater fiscal integrity. This duality suggests a governing philosophy that is simultaneously pro-business in its approach to regulation and, well, pro-state in its approach to fiscal enforcement and data aggregation. It's a highly pragmatic, some might even say opportunistic, approach to governance.
The long-term implications of the CAS reform are particularly noteworthy. This is not merely a technical accounting adjustment. It feels like a strategic effort to reshape the entire federal contracting landscape.
I think so, too. For years, industry groups, particularly those representing small to mid-sized businesses, have argued that the sheer complexity and cost of CAS compliance served as a significant barrier to entry. They claimed it deterred them from even considering federal contracts. And the historic inactivity, frankly, the dysfunction of the CAS board itself, further amplified calls for reform, creating the political justification for such a radical overhaul.
So by dramatically raising the compliance threshold, the administration is making a calculated trade-off. It aims to broaden the industrial base, fostering increased competition and potentially bringing in new technologies and efficiencies.
But, and this is the trade-off, In doing so, it removes a layer of stringent, government-specific cost accounting oversight from a vast number of federal contracts. It essentially shifts a degree of financial risk from contractors back to the government. If those smaller contractors aren't meticulously tracking costs under CAS, it becomes harder for the government to audit and potentially challenge inflated costs down the line. It's a bold move with potentially wide-ranging effects on how the government contracts for goods and services for years to come. A really big shift.
Switching gears slightly within the economic sphere, but staying on this theme of government oversight and proactive measures, the Department of the Treasury made a significant move regarding U.S. Treasury markets that really caught our attention. It seems to signal a shift in their surveillance posture.
That's a key point, yes, because this is a very deliberate and somewhat unusual action. On September 9th, the Department of the Treasury issued a call for large position reports, or LPRs. This is a powerful, though pretty sparingly used, regulatory tool they have to monitor the U.S. government securities market.
Specifically, they required any entity holding positions of $6.9 billion or more in a particular security, the 4.58% Treasury bonds of February 2055, identified by CUSIP, 912810UG1, to submit a detailed report. That's a very specific bond.
It is. The purpose of these LPR rules is explicitly to monitor concentrations of positions and guard against potential market manipulation, like a squeeze, where one entity might try to corner the market on a specific bond issue, allowing him to dictate prices to others who need that bond. Now, the Treasury was careful to state that large holdings are not inherently problematic, and there's no presumption of manipulative intent.
But the very act of issuing an LPR is a significant signal in itself, isn't it? The market definitely notices.
Absolutely. What makes this really stand out, and where the proactive aspect becomes clear, is the context in which this call was issued. According to reports, this request for information on a long-duration 30-year bond was made despite no major indications of potential market manipulation.
Really? So no warning signs in the public data?
Apparently not. Data from the New York Fed at the time showed no unusual surge in transaction failures for 30-year bonds, and demand to borrow this specific security in daily lending operations remained light. The absence of public signs of market stress is a critical detail here. It clearly suggests a shift in Treasury's surveillance posture from being purely reactive, you know, waiting for a crisis, to actively preemptive, looking ahead to potential risks.
So we're left to speculate a bit on the reasons then, aren't we? What could be behind it?
It could be intended as a deterrent signal to the market, sort of a subtle warning shot that Treasury is watching very closely.
Oh.
Or it could be a data-gathering exercise based on non-public intelligence, perhaps whispers in the market or proprietary analytical models that aren't publicly visible, but hint at underlying vulnerabilities.
Maybe even a wargaming exercise, testing their tools.
That's possible, too. Testing industry compliance in their own internal systems to ensure readiness for future, more acute market events. It represents a more sophisticated and proactive use of regulatory authority, aiming to maintain market stability rather than just react to its breakdown.
And the timing of the report itself offers some important clues about its purpose, right?
Yes. The call, announced on September 9, 2025, requires reporting on positions held as of June 2, 2025. That's a significant lag of over 3 months.
Right. If it were a crisis now, they'd want data from today.
Exactly. A real-time market crisis would necessitate a much more immediate data call. This delay indicates that the purpose of the exercise is analytical and retrospective rather than operational. It's highly plausible that Treasury officials observed some anomaly in pricing or settlement patterns, or perhaps unusual trading volumes, around that June 2nd date, and are now using their regulatory authority to conduct a forensic analysis.
So figure out who did what when.
Pretty much. By identifying the key players and the size of their positions during that specific historical period, Treasury can better understand the behavior of large market participants and the flow of capital. The findings from this data call could subsequently inform future policy regarding auctions, issuance, or regulation of long-duration bonds. And that's particularly important in a macroeconomic environment currently characterized by high volatility, persistent inflation concerns, and a massive national debt, all of which put pressure on the Treasury market.
So this isn't just data gathering. It's Treasury subtly yet firmly asserting its preeminence and gathering intelligence for future policy.
Interesting.
Okay.
Moving from the domestic economic front, let's pivot to the complex and, well, often contradictory world of geopolitics. The past 2 days saw some really high-stakes international maneuvering revealing the delicate balance the U.S. is trying to strike globally.
Yeah, this period truly underscored the challenges of aligning domestic political priorities with long-term strategic foreign policy goals. We saw a series of diplomatic engagements that revealed the often contradictory realities of the administration's international relations, especially, I think, in the Indo-Pacific.
Let's start with a significant diplomatic crisis involving a key U.S. ally, South Korea. On September 10th, Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with Republic of Korea, or ROK, Foreign Minister Cho Hyun at the White House. Now, this was far from a routine meeting. Reports suggest it was an emergency intervention aimed at diffusing a rapidly escalating bilateral crisis.
Precisely. And this intervention was triggered by a massive U.S. immigration raid earlier in the month, specifically targeting a Hyundai LG electric vehicle battery factory currently under construction in Georgia. This operation was not minor. It was the largest worksite enforcement operation of the president's second term, resulting in the detention of 475 workers.
And crucially, over 300 of those detained were South Korean nationals. They were there to help set up this complex manufacturing facility, right? Skilled technicians.
Exactly. The incident caused immense public outrage in South Korea, a critical U.S. ally central to, well, the previous administration's Indo-Pacific strategy, and still very important now. Images of shackled Korean workers in detention sparked a strong emotional and political reaction. Officials and media outlets decried the U.S. administration's actions as contradictory, impulsive, even a slap in the face to a key partner.
And this crisis immediately cast a dark shadow over and directly threatened a landmark $350 billion South Korean investment package in the United States. That package was a central component of a recently concluded bilateral trade and tariff agreement. That's a colossal amount of money and a significant piece of alliance cooperation now very much at risk due to these domestic enforcement actions.
It's huge. And the diplomatic messaging from the two capitals following that September 10th meeting was strikingly divergent, really revealing the differing priorities. The official U.S. State Department readout was notably brief and generic. It made no mention of the raid at all.
Really? Just ignored it?
Completely. It focused instead on emphasizing the lasting strength of the U.S.-ROK alliance and welcoming ROK investment into the U.S. It was designed to project an image of, you know, business as usual.
But the South Koreans weren't having that.
Not at all. In stark contrast, South Korean government statements and media reports made it abundantly clear that Foreign Minister Cho's visit had a singular urgent purpose to secure the swift and safe repatriation of the detained workers, and also to press for systemic changes to the U.S. visa system to prevent this from happening again.
What kind of changes?
Seoul's specific concerns included the need for clearer U.S. guidelines on the use of B-1 short-term business visas, which many of these technicians were using, and the creation of a new, distinct work permit category for skilled Korean professionals who are essential for building and launching these advanced high-tech manufacturing facilities. They need clarity.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, this crisis really exposes a deep and, frankly, destabilizing contradiction at the heart of U.S. strategic policy, doesn't it?
I think it absolutely does. On one hand, the administration's geopolitical and economic strategy is supposed to be about countering China's dominance by onshoring critical supply chains, like these advanced EV batteries, through massive investments from trusted allies like South Korea. President Trump himself had previously called Hyundai's investments beautiful and vital to American job creation.
And on the other hand?
On the other hand, the administration's domestic political agenda demands a hardline America First immigration enforcement policy. This is often driven by a desire to demonstrate control over the border and the labor market, appealing to a certain base.
So the raid in Georgia represents a direct and, you said, brutal collision of these two objectives.
It really does. The U.S. government was, in effect, simultaneously incentivizing and then punishing a key ally for the exact same activity, bringing skilled workers to build critical infrastructure in the U.S. This is not a minor diplomatic hiccup, as some might try to frame it. It's a structural policy conflict that signals profound unreliability to all foreign investors looking to build in the U.S. It potentially undermines the entire onshoring strategy that's supposed to be so critical for U.S. economic and national security.
It creates a perception, then, that investment in America comes with unpredictable political risks that might outweigh the economic benefits.
Precisely. And the root of this conflict appears to be what some analysts are calling the weaponization of bureaucratic ambiguity.
Explain that.
Well, for years, South Korean companies had operated in a kind of gray zone, using short-term B-1 business visas and ESTA visa waivers to bring skilled engineers and technicians to the U.S. for the essential setup, installation, and training phases of new plants. This was a practice largely tolerated by previous administrations, sort of a quiet understanding that facilitated international business.
Okay.
The current administration, however, chose to unilaterally reverse this unspoken understanding with an aggressive, highly visible enforcement action. This transforms a long-standing bureaucratic ambiguity into a potent enforcement weapon that can be deployed for domestic political purposes. It creates immense uncertainty for international businesses and injects a new, significant layer of political risk into foreign direct investment in the United States. This is a profound shift in how the U.S. interacts with its economic partners, a really worrying signal for allies.
So while the U.S. was managing this very public diplomatic crisis with South Korea, the Pentagon was also engaged in its own dual-track diplomacy, reinforcing other key partnerships while simultaneously managing complex rivalries in the Indo-Pacific. Busy couple of days.
That's right. On September 10th, the Department of War conducted two high-profile diplomatic engagements that, taken together, painted a clear picture of its multifaceted strategy for the Indo-Pacific. They're reinforcing partnerships with reliable allies while managing intense competition with a strategic rival. And the deliberate scheduling of these events on the same day is a story in itself, I think.
Okay, so the first engagement was a highly productive meeting at the Pentagon between Secretary of War Pete Hegseth and Singapore Minister for Defense Chan Chun-Sing.
Right. This meeting served to reaffirm the excellent and longstanding bilateral defense relationship between the two nations. Singapore is a cornerstone of U.S. presence in Southeast Asia.
And there was a tangible outcome.
Yes. Crucially, Minister Chan used the occasion to announce Singapore's decision to acquire four Boeing P-8A Poseidon Maritime Patrol aircraft. This isn't just another arms deal. The P-8A is a highly advanced multi-mission aircraft. It significantly enhances the Singapore Armed Forces' capabilities in maritime situational awareness, anti-submarine warfare, and intelligence gathering across a vast maritime expanse.
So a big upgrade for them.
A huge upgrade. Replaces an aging fleet of Fokker 50s and deepens interoperability with U.S. forces, which also operate the P-8A extensively in the region. The meeting clearly underscored the deep level of trust and operational collaboration between the two militaries. Both sides welcomed closer collaboration on emerging threats and R&D. A very tangible outcome for the partnership. Very positive readout.
Okay, so that's the friendly meeting. Then, in stark contrast, the second engagement on the very same day was a video call between Secretary Hegseth and the People's Republic of China, the PRC Minister of National Defense, Admiral Dong Jun. And the readouts from this call, released by both sides, were strikingly different, highlighting the persistent chasm in their strategic perspectives.
Indeed. The U.S. summary was notably procedural and, well, de-escalatory. It described the exchange as candid and constructive, and clarify that the United States does not seek conflict with China. It emphasized the importance of maintaining open lines of communication. Standard stuff.
But the Chinese readout.
Highly confrontational and much more forceful. It reported that Admiral Dong warned the U.S. that any effort to contain, deter, or interfere with China will be futile. He also demanded that Washington respect China's core interests, with a very specific and pointed warning that any attempt to use Taiwan to contain China will be thwarted. That is not the language of de-escalation or constructive dialogue.
This precise scheduling, putting these two distinct engagements on the same day, it feels like a deliberate act of strategic communication, doesn't it? The Pentagon is creating a very clear, contrasting message for the region. But does that contrast always land as intended? Or could it sometimes be perceived as maybe inconsistent, particularly by other regional players who are carefully watching both interactions?
That's a crucial question, and it really depends on the audience, doesn't it? For allies, it's designed to be reassuring. For rivals, a show of strength and resolve. It's a classic contrast and compare narrative, precisely because it's trying to manage multiple perceptions simultaneously across the Indo-Pacific.
Okay, explain that.
On one side, you have the U.S.-Singapore partnership, portrayed as productive, reliable, mutually beneficial, yielding tangible security benefits like access to advanced U.S. military tech. Thumbs up. On the other, the U.S.-China relationship is characterized by tension, distrust, fundamental strategic disagreement, but with the U.S. still seeking to prevent miscalculation. Thumbs down, but talking. This juxtaposition allows the Pentagon to publicly demonstrate both its capacity for robust alliance building and its resolve in managing great power competition. It reinforces its preferred narrative for regional partners who are weighing their strategic alignment. It's a calculated diplomatic tightrope walk.
And the content of the U.S.-China call, which occurred just 1 week after the PRC's massive Victory Day military parade, the one that showcased new nuclear and anti-Caesarea denial capabilities, that timing further indicates that the dialogue's primary purpose is deconfliction, not really rapprochement or genuine reconciliation.
Absolutely. The U.S. focus on process maintaining open lines of communication to prevent miscalculation and accidental escalation in a highly militarized environment is a long-standing feature of its approach to military-to-military talks with Beijing. It's about reducing the risk of a regional conflict spiraling out of control. Risk management.
Well, China.
China, however, appears to use these engagements more as a platform for ideological signaling and to publicly reiterate its non-negotiable red lines, particularly regarding Taiwan and its claims in the South China Sea. These talks become a stage for them to reinforce the coercive message of their recent military display, asserting their rise in power. So while both sides are technically talking, they're often talking past each other. They're engaged in a risk management exercise rather than a genuine effort to resolve their deep-seated conflicts.
Finally, in our look at geopolitical maneuvering, the U.S. showcased its economic statecraft in action, this time in West Africa, through a significant development aid package, a different kind of tool.
Yes, on September 10th, the U.S. government demonstrated its use of development aid as a precise tool of foreign policy with the signing of a Millennium Challenge Corporation, or MCC, compact with Cote d'Ivoire. The ceremony, held at the Department of State, featured Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Lando and Cote d'Ivoire's ambassador to the U.S., Ibrahima Touré, highlighting the high-level commitment.
This agreement is more than just aid, isn't it? It's described as a regional energy compact specifically designed to bolster West Africa's energy security and reduce costs by increasing Cote d'Ivoire's ability to trade electricity on the regional market. Now, for you listening, this might sound like a distant issue, but energy security is a fundamental building block for economic stability and growth, which in turn influences regional peace and ultimately U.S. interests.
Definitely. The program involves a substantial $300 million grant from the MCC, supplemented by a significant $22.5 million contribution from the government of Cote d'Ivoire itself, which demonstrates local ownership and commitment. That's key for MCC programs. The compact's three main activities are strategically focused: supporting the ECOWAS regional electricity market, which promotes cross-border energy trade; modernizing Cote d'Ivoire's domestic grid to reduce power losses and increase reliability; and improving the governance and financial viability of regional energy institutions, building capacity.
And the U.S. government publicly framed the compact as, quote, smart, accountable development that advances U.S. interests by creating new markets for American companies and contributing to regional stability.
Right, which raises an important question for us. What's the deeper why behind this particular investment beyond the stated goals of energy security? What larger strategic game is being played here?
Good question. What's the answer?
Well, this action should absolutely be understood as a key element of U.S. geopolitical strategy, particularly in its competition for influence with rivals like China and Russia on the African continent. The MCC is a primary instrument of American soft power, specifically designed to offer an alternative to the development models proposed by strategic rivals, most notably China's Belt and Road Initiative.
How is it an alternative?
Unlike many Chinese-backed projects, which often come with opaque loan terms and fewer governance requirements, MCC compacts are conditional. Partner countries must meet rigorous standards for good governance, fighting corruption, and respecting democratic rights to be eligible for and to maintain funding. This values-based conditional approach is a core part of the U.S. value proposition. It aims to foster sustainable development and democratic institutions rather than just infrastructure, though infrastructure is part of it.
So by investing in critical infrastructure like the regional energy grid, the U.S. is not merely providing aid, it's embedding its own standards of transparency, governance, and market economics in a strategically important region, directly countering the influence of competitors.
Exactly. It's about building long-term relationships based on shared values, or at least shared standards of operation. It's a different model.
It's a long-term play, really, almost a form of geopolitical engineering, you could say. By funding projects that strengthen the West African power pool and facilitate cross-border energy trade, the U.S. is investing in a future where the economic fortunes of West African nations are more closely intertwined.
Precisely. Economically integrated regions are generally less prone to interstate conflict and more resilient to external shocks or the malign influence of a single dominant power. Stable, prosperous, and interconnected nations in West Africa are less likely to fall prey to extremist ideologies or to become economic dependencies of rival powers. This strategy uses development funding to foster a more stable, prosperous, and frankly, U.S.-friendly environment in a critical part of the world. It creates a bulwark against instability and rival influence, and ultimately advances long-term U.S. security and economic interest. It's smart power in action.
Okay, let's bring it back home now and look at the domestic legal and legislative landscape. The Department of Justice in particular has been exceptionally active over these 2 days, revealing a clear alignment with the administration's broader agenda.
Yes, the activities of the Department of Justice and the legislative branch during this period revealed a clear focus on advancing the administration's core political and social priorities. They're using a combination of legal enforcement and congressional agenda setting. And while the Supreme Court itself was quiet on new opinions, a lower court case signaled a significant looming battle over the scope of executive power, which could be monumental down the road.
So over the 2-day period, the Department of Justice issued a flurry of press releases covering a wide range of enforcement actions. What really stand out here for you listening are the actions that are clearly, almost explicitly, aligned with the administration's specific political agenda and messaging.
Indeed. In that category, the DOJ announced a federal court consent order requiring North Carolina to maintain a more accurate voter list. Okay, that might sound technical, but the department explicitly tied this action to President Trump's Executive Order 14248 on preserving and protecting the integrity of American elections, a central theme of his political platform. So it wasn't presented as just routine list maintenance.
Got it. What else?
Additionally, the department's Religious Liberty Commission hosted a high-profile hearing featuring President Trump himself and Attorney General Pam Bondi to discuss perceived threats to religious freedom in public schools. This is a key issue for the administration's social conservative political base.
So these announcements function not just as legal updates, but as powerful political signals, demonstrating that the DOJ is actively prosecuting the administration's key cultural and political battles.
I think that's a fair assessment. This selective amplification of actions that align with the White House's political agenda effectively positions the department as a key messaging apparatus for the administration, showing its commitment to its base on these hot-button issues.
Beyond the politically aligned actions, the DOJ also highlighted a consistent and sustained focus on the welfare of military service members, another critical constituency for this administration.
That's right. They announced a favorable court ruling protecting the civilian pension benefits of service members in Guam.
And there was another case.
Yes. In a separate but related action, the DOJ announced a settlement with Lincoln Military Housing to resolve allegations of unlawful evictions of active duty personnel under the Service Members Civil Relief Act, which provides legal and financial protections to military members. The presence of multiple distinct cases addressing the financial and housing security of military personnel strongly suggests this is a sustained departmental priority. It reflects a broader administration focus on this key constituency.
It sends a message. We're looking out for you.
Exactly. It's not just about individual cases. Mm-hmm. It's about signaling to the entire military community that their welfare is being actively protected by the government.
And of course, the department also announced a series of standard but still significant criminal and corporate enforcement actions that demonstrate the breadth of its regular duties.
Right. The day-to-day work continues. These included filing federal charges against an individual for a fatal attack on the Charlotte light rail system, securing a guilty plea from a man who attempted to use a weapon of mass destruction in Nashville, highlighting ongoing domestic security threats.
Obtaining a judgment of over $1.1 million against defendants in a nationwide foreclosure defense scheme, protecting vulnerable homeowners, and reaching a settlement with Norfolk Southern to resolve allegations of unlawfully delaying Amtrak passenger trains, which impacts transportation and commerce. So a wide array of actions, many with clear political messaging, but also covering the core functions of justice.
Absolutely. A busy couple of days for DOJ press releases.
Moving over to the legislative branch, the congressional agenda for these 2 days seemed less about immediate high-profile legislative action and more about the intricate behind-the-scenes work of policy formulation. You called it a workshop phase earlier.
That's a keen observation, I think. The most significant legislative activity on September 9th was that hearing by the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee's Subcommittee on Healthcare and Financial Services, the one titled Better Meals, Fewer Pills, Making Our Children Healthy Again. This hearing serves as a clear example of the legislative branch being used to amplify and build a case for the executive branch's policy agenda, reinforcing the MAHA narrative we discussed earlier.
So, featuring testimony from senior officials from HHS and the Department of Agriculture, the hearing provided a public platform to detail the problems like the negative health impacts of ultra-processed foods on children and the perceived overprescription of medications like SSRIs to adolescents.
Right. These are precisely the problems that the administration's Make America Healthy Again initiative is designed to solve. This created a powerful, almost symbiotic relationship. The president's memorandum on drug advertising, issued the same day, provided the policy solution, while the congressional hearing provided the public problem statement. It results in a powerful, coordinated narrative across both branches of government. It's a masterful way to shape public opinion and build support for executive actions.
Then on September 10th, the U.S. House of Representatives had no floor activity or roll call vote scheduled, which is often telling, isn't it?
It usually indicates work is happening elsewhere. Instead, the day was filled with a dense schedule of committee hearings and markups on a wide array of topics: small business contracting, artificial intelligence policy, environmental regulations, various specific pieces of legislation. This lack of major floor action, combined with intense committee work, indicates that the House is deeply in a workshop phase of the legislative process. Committees are where the details of policy are hammered out, bills are amended, and often where bipartisan or highly partisan negotiations take place away from the glare of the House floor. The packed schedule of markups for bills such as H.R. 5183, the District of Columbia Home Rule Improvement Act, and H.R. 4371, the Kayla Hamilton Act, suggests that major legislative packages are still being assembled. They're not yet ready for consideration by the full chamber.
And the Senate.
In contrast, the Senate was active, holding several roll call votes on judicial and executive branch nominations. This indicates their focus was more on appointments rather than debating policy details at this moment, confirming judges and officials.
So, what does this all mean for the judiciary? While the Supreme Court itself didn't issue any new orders or opinions on September 9th or 10th, there are some significant judicial developments from lower courts and even from the Chief Justice himself that bear watching, particularly concerning executive power and that delicate balance of government.
You're right to highlight the Chief Justice's actions. On September 9th, Chief Justice John Roberts temporarily kept in place the Trump administration's decision to freeze nearly $5 billion in congressionally approved foreign aid.
This was the pocket rescission thing, right?
Exactly. President Trump had invoked what's known as a pocket rescission, a highly disputed executive authority. Basically, a president submits a request to Congress late in a budget year to not spend approved money, effectively bypassing the normal legislative appropriations process and avoiding congressional action within a 45-day window. This specific controversial authority was last successfully used about 50 years ago, which highlights the rare and contentious nature of this executive maneuver. It's a big power grab, essentially.
So Roberts' temporary order to keep the freeze in place, what does that suggest?
It suggests that the justices may indeed be considering reversing a lower court ruling by U.S. District Judge Amir Ali, who had found that withholding the funding was likely illegal. Justice Department lawyers had previously stated that another $6.5 billion subject to the freeze would be spent by September 30th, the end of the fiscal year,
right,
which complicates the legal maneuvering.
And the administration's stance?
They've made deep foreign aid reductions a hallmark policy, despite what critics say are meager savings relative to the deficit and possible damage to America's reputation abroad, end quote. Roberts has asked the plaintiffs to respond to the administration's emergency appeal by Friday, so this is an ongoing constitutional showdown about the separation of powers and spending. Who controls the purse strings, Congress or the president? In another judicial development with potentially wide-ranging implications for the federal workforce, on September 9th, a federal appeals court dismissed a significant case led by 19 states and the District of Columbia. This case challenged the Trump administration's mass firing of probationary federal employees, an action that affected an estimated 24,000 individuals early in their federal careers.
And the court said,
the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit stated that claims of increased unemployment due to the firings were not enough to challenge the federal government's ability to manage the size of its workforce. Effectively, the court ruled that the states lacked the legal standing to challenge these firings on the basis of broader economic impact. They sent the case back to a lower court with instructions to dismiss it. This is a significant win for the administration in its efforts to reshape the federal civil service and assert more control over hiring and firing.
So, what does this all mean for the fundamental separation of powers? Beyond these immediate actions, you mentioned a truly significant legal battle is brewing, one that could have long-lasting implications for the independence of the administrative state.
This is potentially a profound legal challenge to executive authority. Yes, on September 10th, a U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit filing became public. It detailed the court's denial of the administration's request to stay a lower court order. And that lower court order had reinstated Federal Trade Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter, whom President Trump had fired without cause.
Fired without cause. That's the key phrase, isn't it?
It is. The court's opinion didn't mince words. It cited controlling and directly on-point Supreme Court precedent, specifically referencing the 90-year-old case, Humphrey's Executor v. United States.
Okay, remind us what Humphrey's Executor established. Crucial for you to understand this one.
It drew a clear line. It said that for certain officers of independent quasi-judicial or quasi-legislative agencies, agencies meant to be insulated from direct political pressure, like the FTC, a president can't just fire them at will. They can only be removed for cause, like proven neglect of duty or malfeasance. This legal precedent is designed to protect the independence of these regulatory bodies from raw political interference, allowing them to make decisions based on law and evidence, not presidential whim.
So this ongoing legal fight signals a potential future Supreme Court confrontation over the fundamental separation of powers and, critically, the president's authority over the administrative state itself.
Absolutely. If the president can fire heads of independent agencies without cause, it fundamentally redefines the balance of power, concentrating much more authority in the executive branch. This isn't just about Commissioner Slaughter. It's about the very independence of the regulatory state. It asks whether a president can truly control every arm of government, even those explicitly designed by Congress to operate outside direct political influence. It's a battle that could define the boundaries of executive power and the independence of regulatory bodies for decades to come. Huge stakes.
Okay, so we've unpacked how the administration is flexing its muscles in the legal and legislative arenas, setting the stage for some significant power struggles. But policies and court rulings don't exist in a vacuum, do they? They inevitably ripple through the very engine of government and the broader economy.
That's right.
Let's turn our attention now to the more tangible day-to-day impacts of federal activity. From the desks of civil servants to the national job market. It's where these grand policy ambitions meet the ground truth, so to speak.
Absolutely. And this area reveals a real mix of persistent administrative challenges, strategic reorganizations driven by the administration's vision for government, and some, well, concerning economic data that directly impacts millions of Americans.
Let's start with something many federal employees experience directly. On September 9th, new data from the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, for August showed that federal employees are waiting, on average, 70 days for their retirement applications to be processed. 70 days.
Wow.
For those claims received in less than 60 days, the average was 45 days. OPM received over 9,400 claims last month. And I guess the good news is the backlog did drop by 2,000 to 24,300. So some movement there.
But still, a 70-day average wait for your retirement application. I mean, you can almost hear the collective groan from federal employees checking their mailboxes, can't you? It's a situation ripe for frustration.
And it's a clear indicator of the persistent challenges within federal operational efficiency, especially for something as critical as retirement planning.
Definitely. This backlog impacts federal employees' financial security and their ability to transition smoothly into retirement. It creates real stress for them and their families. It's a chronic problem that OPM has struggled with across multiple administrations, to be fair.
And looking at the physical infrastructure where many of these federal employees work, concerns remain about federal building conditions. Employees are reporting issues like mold, pests, and broken elevators in federal buildings across the country. This reflects what's been described as a multi-billion dollar maintenance backlog.
And this comes as President Trump, in a recent executive order, outlined his preference for how federal buildings should look, emphasizing a return to classical architectural styles. It suggests a focus on appearance despite these underlying systemic maintenance issues that affect daily work life for thousands.
Right. In a related development, the General Services Administration, or GSA, which manages much of the federal real estate portfolio, informed its staff on September 9th and 10th that no more layoffs are planned for its Public Building Service, or PBS.
That's significant because it comes after major workforce cuts earlier in the Trump administration, which at one point envisioned a drastic 63% reduction in PBS employees. That caused significant disruption and uncertainty for those workers.
So PBS will proceed with a reorganization starting in mid-October. The aim is making the service more agile, customer-focused, and streamlining federal operations. This follows recent leadership shakeups at both GSA and PBS, indicating a push from the top to implement the administration's vision.
And the administration's broader goal here is quite ambitious, to shed 50% of government real estate, selling off federal buildings, moving federal employees to leased offices. GSA is actively helping agencies like HUD relocate, aiming to reduce the government's physical footprint and maintenance costs. It's addressing that multi-billion dollar backlog through divestment rather than direct investment in repairs.
So this approach to federal real estate management is a key part of the administration's cost-cutting and efficiency narrative. For you as a taxpayer, the promise is reduced government spending on property.
True, but it also raises questions, doesn't it? About the long-term impact on the federal workforce, potential disruption during relocations, and whether leased spaces will truly offer better or more cost-effective solutions in the long run, especially if the government becomes reliant on private landlords. It's a significant shift in how the federal government perceives and utilizes its physical assets. A fundamental change.
We also saw some high-level departures in federal leadership on September 9th, indicating a churn at the top of critical agencies.
Yeah. Deputy Federal CIO Drew Michelgard is leaving OMB on September 22nd for the private sector. He'd been focused on IT modernization and cloud computing, including updates to FedRAMP, a key security authorization program.
And Derek Turnier, the director of the Space Development Agency, SDA, a crucial agency in developing military space capabilities, is also leaving for academia, joining Auburn University. Gurpratap GP Sandhu will be stepping in as acting director.
This departure, and Michelgard's, is part of what's being described as a growing wave of departures among senior Pentagon leaders and across the broader federal government. This level of turnover can create institutional knowledge gaps and potentially slow down critical initiatives, especially in rapidly evolving fields like cyber and space defense. Stability matters.
On the IT front, a Government Accountability Office GAO report found that the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, still hasn't completed efforts to modernize and consolidate its HR IT system.
Still. How long has this been going on?
Get this. After two decades and over $262 million in spending, a truly staggering amount.
Wow.
DHS still uses more than 80 disparate systems, requiring multiple logins for its 260,000 employees. The GAO recommended a new comprehensive strategy for HRIT modernization, basically highlighting a failure of long-term planning and execution.
You know, this isn't just an IT nuisance for DHS employees. It translates into significant inefficiencies, wasted time managing multiple systems, and potential data integrity issues. And for you as a citizen, it represents a considerable expenditure with little to show for it in terms of streamlined operations. It points to broader issues in federal IT procurement and management. A new strategy is urgently needed, but given the track record, it remains a formidable challenge.
In another internal challenge related to federal employees, 36 FEMA staff currently on administrative leave allege illegal retaliation.
What happened?
These employees had signed what's known as the Katrina Declaration, which stated essentially that Trump administration changes had left FEMA unprepared for major disasters. They were acting as whistleblowers. Yeah. Now they claim violations of whistleblower protection laws and are seeking reinstatement to their positions. It highlights the ongoing tensions between political leadership and career civil servants in some agencies.
And finally, on a more positive note, perhaps, a proactive initiative aimed at capturing institutional knowledge from departing civil servants. The Departure Dialogues Project launched on September 9th.
This is from the POPVOX Foundation, in collaboration with the Niskanen Center and others. It's designed as a unique mechanism for preserving valuable insights.
How does it work?
Its purpose is to provide a safe, nonpartisan platform for departing civil servants to confidentially share their policy observations, highlight operational bottlenecks they experienced, and offer insights directly to Congress. It uses a self-service guided interview, either video or written, and then leverages AI and machine learning through a tool called Talk to the City for sentiment analysis.
So it creates an interactive, searchable archive for lawmakers.
Exactly. And importantly, it offers anonymity to participants, which is crucial for getting frank feedback. The goal is to translate granular feedback into actionable legislative fixes, preventing valuable institutional knowledge from simply walking out the door when experienced employees leave. It's a fascinating way to harness technology for institutional memory. Could be very useful.
That sounds promising.
Now let's look at the broader economic environment and policy decisions that came out over these 2 days. It's a mixed bag, to say the least. Some alarming reports on jobs, ongoing debates about trade and taxation.
It certainly is. On September 10th, the Labor Department reported some rather grim news that sent ripples through economic circles. The U.S. economy added 911,000 fewer jobs from March 2024 to March 2025 than initially reported. That's a 0.6% reduction, estimated to be the largest annual revision in history. It fundamentally changes our understanding of recent job growth. That's a big miss.
And it gets more concerning, right? The monthly report showed unemployment ticked up to 4.3%. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, further revised June data to show a net loss of 13,000 jobs. That's the first net loss since 2020, excluding the immediate COVID-19 lockdown period.
Yeah, and many Republicans, like Rep. Don Bacon and Sen. Jerry Moran, were quick to point fingers at President Trump's global trade war and tariffs. They're blaming them for the weaker-than-expected jobs data, increased prices for consumers, and what they called a slumping economy.
The alarm bells were also ringing from Wall Street and economic analysts, too. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon weighed in, stating the economy is weakening.
And Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, went so far as to declare a jobs recession and expects inflation to grow to nearly 4% due to the cumulative impact of tariffs on imported goods and services. That's a worrying forecast.
But the administration is defending itself.
Oh, yes. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt claimed the BLS data actually justified Trump's efforts to overhaul the agency and pressure the Federal Reserve for interest rate cuts, basically framing the negative data as validation for their reform agenda. Bit of spin there.
There's also some Republican optimism, though. Sen. John Thune believes the economy will pick up due to the recently passed One Big Beautiful Bill Act, while Sen. John Cornyn is hoping the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates soon to stimulate growth. So, conflicting views even within the party.
Standard practice, really. Meanwhile, on September 9th, with Congress facing yet another government funding deadline in 3 weeks, and the specter of a government shutdown looming yet again.
Oh boy, here we go again.
Senator James Lankford and House Budget Chairman Jody Arrington reintroduced their Prevent Government Shutdowns Act. This bill, which has been introduced every year since 2019 but hasn't advanced, would implement an automatic 14-day continuing resolution, or CR, upon a funding lapse. It effectively buys Congress more time and forces them to remain in session until the work is done.
Yeah.
It's a legislative safety net designed to avoid the economic and operational disruptions of a full shutdown. Maybe this time.
We'll see. And in another ripple effect directly tied to trade policy, international mail volume to the U.S. apparently fell by over 80% after the Trump administration's new tariffs on small packages took effect. 80%.
That's a staggering drop. These tariffs, aimed at goods imported through mail, significantly increased costs for many international shippers. As a result, over 90 postal operators worldwide have suspended some or all services to the U.S., severely impacting cross-border e-commerce and personal shipments.
And this dramatic decline in volume is potentially devastating for the U.S. Postal Service, right? They're expecting a nearly $7 billion net loss for FY 2025, primarily due to this drop in international revenue. That's a huge hit.
Massive. Now, on September 10th, we also saw significant corporate tax changes with international implications. The Trump administration notably pulled the U.S. out of a global minimum business tax agreement that had been negotiated with over 130 countries.
Pulled out entirely.
Well, instead, it struck a deal with the G7 group of advanced economies that allowed the U.S. to maintain its own existing corporate minimum tax, effectively carving out a unique position for the U.S.
And new IRS proposed regulations for corporate minimum taxes released back in July were described as more favorable or simpler than previous interpretations.
Right. These regulations have the effect of shrinking the tax base and applying the minimum tax to fewer companies and less income overall. This drew immediate Democratic opposition, naturally. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Angus King accused the IRS of effectively delaying or abandoning corporate alternative minimum taxes, or CAMT, which were designed to ensure large profitable corporations pay at least a minimum share.
International tax advocates argue the U.S. is having it both ways, effectively being exempted from the global agreement while still remaining a party. Is that right?
That's the argument.
a move that could cost EU members direct revenue and may spur a rival initiative at the United Nations, potentially undermining global tax coordination. And Republicans also included a specific provision in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act to further exempt oil and gas companies from CMT. They did this by allowing intangible drilling and development costs, things like geological surveys, site preparation, drilling itself, massive upfront expenses to be factored into income calculations. This effectively reduces their taxable base, a significant win for that industry.
Also on September 10th, we had news about a Federal Reserve Board nomination that's raising some eyebrows regarding the Fed's political independence.
Yes, Senator Tom Tillis announced he will support President Trump's nomination of Steven Miron, who currently heads Trump's Council of Economic Advisers, or CEA, to the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, but only for a short 6-month term.
A short term. And he's head of the CEA. That sounds unusual.
It is. Tillis himself expressed concerns about political independence, noting that Miron plans an unpaid leave from CEA and doesn't intend to leave permanently. This revolving door approach raises questions about whether Miron would truly be an independent voice on the Fed board, or if his decisions would be influenced by his prior and expected future role in the administration.
But Tillis supports it anyway.
He supports the short-term role specifically to avoid what he called people surfing back and forth between senior administration roles and the Fed's board. He emphasized that serving on the Fed board should be a one-way sort of thing to maintain its perceived impartiality. It's a delicate balancing act for a body whose independence is considered crucial for economic stability. A bit of a compromise there, too.
And finally, for all you federal employees listening out there, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, passed over the summer, is having a notable impact on federal employee retirement planning, even if most direct federal benefits were unscathed. These are changes you really need to be aware of.
Absolutely. While most direct federal benefits, like your core FERS pension or FEHB, remained untouched, other provisions in the bill certainly affect your financial planning.
Okay, what should people know?
For Social Security, there's a temporary additional deduction of $6,000 for individuals, $12,000 for married couples, for those 65 and older from 2025-2028. But this phases out for higher modified adjusted gross income, or NGI, so check your income level. For retirement income and investments, the bill permanently extends the 2017 lower income tax rates for investment withdrawals. That means retirees get to keep more from their thrift savings plan, IRAs, and 401ks, which is good news for many.
The state and local tax, or SALT, cap was also increased to $40,000, offering some relief. But this benefit, of course, requires itemization on your taxes. Still a cap, but higher.
Right. And here's a key change. Some federal employees who contribute to a TSP and earn over $79,000 as a single filer, or $146,000 if married filing jointly, can no longer deduct traditional IRA contributions. That's a significant change to how many plan for retirement, and it reduces their tax advantage savings options. You need to look at Roth IRAs, perhaps.
Okay. What about healthcare ripple effects?
Well, the Congressional Budget Office estimates Medicaid provisions within the bill could decrease the number of insured by 7.8 million by 2034. This could potentially increase indirect costs for Medicare users as more individuals rely on fewer safety nets, putting more pressure on the system overall.
And looking ahead, the bill also created Trump accounts. These new investment accounts designed for children born between 2025 and 2028.
Right. These accounts will start with a $1,000 government deposit and allow for up to $5,000 in annual contributions from parents or grandparents, aiming to jumpstart long-term savings for the next generation. An interesting experiment.
So given these continuous legislative changes, it's more important than ever to engage in regular consultations with certified federal retirement consultants to navigate these complexities and ensure your financial plan remains on track. Things keep changing.
Absolutely crucial. Don't try to navigate this alone.
Lastly, let's touch on some social and cultural debates that have been prominent in the federal news this week. These highlight the administration's broader social agenda and its intersection with policy.
Yeah, these areas, particularly around public health and cultural values, reveal deep divisions and strong ideological drivers behind some of these policy decisions.
On September 10th, Florida made headlines with its anti-vaccine stance, a move that immediately ignited national debate. The Florida Department of Health banned vaccine mandates for school children for diseases like hepatitis B, chickenpox, Haemophilus influenza type B, HIB, and pneumococcal diseases,
making it the first state to do so for those specific vaccines. However, mandates for polio, measles, mumps, and tetanus remain due to specific state laws that predate this action. So it's not a total ban on all mandates.
This move caused significant division even within the GOP, didn't it? Republicans like Senators Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia and Tom Tillis of North Carolina called it a horrible idea and stated it was clearly not rooted in science.
But Florida Surgeon General Joseph Lodapo defended it as upholding parents' rights, yet notably admitted no data analysis was done on the potential impact on disease outbreaks. That immediately raised huge public health concerns.
And this Florida action connects directly to the Trump administration's broader MAHA strategy report, the one driven by HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Right. That report outlines a vaccine framework, focusing on what it calls the best childhood vaccine schedule, addressing vaccine injuries, modernizing American vaccines, ensuring scientific and medical freedom, and correcting conflicts of interest within the vaccine industry. Lots of loaded terms there.
Secretary Kennedy has claimed that over 99% of vaccine injuries go unreported, referencing a 2006-09 study. Though an author of that study has publicly pushed back on his characterization, stating it was taken out of context.
And President Trump himself recently shared a video highlighting the long discredited theory linking vaccines to autism, further fueling the controversy.
Democrats predictably are warning of a public health crisis if officials don't focus on scientific consensus, citing the potential for widespread outbreaks of communicable diseases like measles or chickenpox returning.
Interestingly, Republican Rep. Rich McCormick downplayed those public health threats and instead blamed Democrats for any potential outbreaks, attributing them to lenient border policies that he claimed bring people unvaccinated with known disease into the country. Highly politicized, clearly.
The MAHA strategy report also touched on environmental toxins, another topic that often pits business interests against public health advocacy.
Yes, the report described the EPA's existing pesticide review procedures as robust and did not specify reforms for chemicals beyond, basically protecting against pests and increasing innovative growing solutions for farmers. This stance aligns with pro-business Republicans favoring less regulation, but drew immediate ire from MAHA-aligned activists who are pushing for addressing chemical contamination, especially as the EPA has recently stated plans to weaken rules on toxic chemicals and exempt certain polluters from stricter oversight. The tension here is between economic growth and environmental protection, with the administration clearly favoring the former in this instance.
On September 10th, HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. also made waves by suggesting a link between gun violence, specifically mass shootings since the 1990s, and psychiatric drugs, video games, and social media.
That's a highly controversial and often debated assertion, lacking strong scientific consensus connecting those factors directly to mass shootings in that way.
And in line with the MAHA initiative, the NIH and FDA are now directed to investigate repurposing existing drugs for chronic disease and studying potential causes of autism and fluoride in drinking water. These directives indicate a broad and some might say unconventional approach to public health research priorities, definitely outside the mainstream for NIH.
Shifting to a different kind of controversy altogether, the Jeffrey Epstein birthday letter became publicly known on September 10th, injecting a significant political scandal into the news cycle.
Right. A letter matching a Wall Street Journal description became public, shared with the House Oversight Committee by Epstein's estate. It bears President Trump's name, features typewritten text framed by a drawing of a naked woman,
with squiggly Donald below her waist, mimicking pubic hair, and concludes with the highly suggestive line, "Happy birthday, and may every day be another wonderful secret." Just,
Wow. This revelation makes President Trump's earlier strong denial, calling it a fake thing, and claiming he never wrote a picture in my life, now appear very flimsy, to put it mildly.
Yeah, his $10 billion defamation lawsuit against the Wall Street Journal, launched after their initial report, now seems to have a vanishingly small chance of success, given the letter's public emergence.
The White House defense has been varied and somewhat shifting. Vice President Vance's previous complete and utter bull's social media post regarding the letter was recirculated by Democrats to highlight the administration's changing story.
White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt claimed the signature on the letter was not authentic and that Trump neither drew nor signed it. But media outlets have noted other Trump signatures from the same period appear virtually identical to the one on the letter, further undermining the defense.
The political fallout has included awkward encounters for GOP members fielding questions about it, and led Democrats to renew calls for the release of full, unredacted Epstein files, hoping to uncover more connections. This story isn't going away.
Doesn't seem like it. President Trump also weighed into the New York City mayoral election on September 10th, despite his, shall we say, complicated history and often critical view of the city.
This intervention felt highly strategic for him. Allies debated if a win by Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani would be beneficial as a foil for midterm elections, providing a clear ideological opponent, or problematic for the city itself and potentially for broader Republican narratives.
Trump himself was not subtle. He called Mamdani a communist lunatic, threatened to investigate his immigration status, and threatened to withhold federal funding from New York City if Mamdani wins. Standard Trump playbook, really.
And he controversially urged other candidates, including incumbent Mayor Eric Adams and Curtis Sliwa, to drop out to create a one-on-one race against former New York Gov Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat with whom Trump has a very contentious history. That was unexpected.
Very. The latest New York Times Siena College poll on September 10th showed Mamdani leading the four-way race with 46% support, a significant 22 points over Cuomo. And he maintained a strong lead in a hypothetical head-to-head with Cuomo. This polling data underscores the seriousness of Mamdani's challenge.
Mamdani's campaign, in a shrewd political move, leveraged the freakout among New York's wealthy over his affordability platform, which included proposals like increased property taxes on luxury homes by releasing a viral video featuring a Gilded Age actor reading a New York Times article on the topic, effectively turning the criticism into a campaign asset.
Big.
Very clever.
Indeed. And finally, on September 10th, a federal court issued an order that temporarily halted the enforcement of a discriminatory policy within the Trump administration regarding passports.
What was this about?
The court ordered the administration to process passport applications for six transgender and non-binary Americans with sex markers reflecting their gender identity, affirming their right to accurate identification documents. This ruling provides crucial relief for these individuals and represents a step forward in recognizing gender identity in official documentation, pushing back against administration policy.
Okay, let's turn now to national security and defense. We saw some critical updates here regarding cyber strategy and global conflicts. These are areas where the U.S. is constantly adapting to evolving threats and complex international dynamics.
Yeah, this section really highlights the ongoing efforts to adapt to modern warfare, particularly in the digital domain, and the persistent complexities of international relations where quick decisions can have immediate, far-reaching consequences.
On September 9th, a new think tank report, co-authored by Mark Montgomery and Erica Lonergan from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, provided a detailed roadmap for establishing a separate U.S. cyber service, a cyber force.
This is significant because the Pentagon has historically opposed a standalone cyber service, preferring to integrate cyber capabilities within existing branches. But the Trump administration has indicated it is more open to the idea, suggesting a potential shift in strategy.
Why the push for a separate service?
The report argues that the current model, where Cyber Command relies on existing military services like the Army, Navy, and Air Force for its personnel, has led to persistent readiness issues. They contend it results in inconsistent knowledge and experience among what they call digital warriors, because cyber specialists rotate through traditional military roles, often losing their edge. This also creates a broken force generation system, making it difficult to recruit, train, and retain top cyber talent.
So what's the proposal?
Their proposal is for Cyber Command to remain the force employer, setting missions and managing operations, while the new cyber force would organize, train, and equip personnel specifically for defensive, offensive, and cyber intelligence missions. Crucially, it would not be responsible for securing the entire DoD network or information warfare or artificial intelligence. Its focus would be on direct cyber combat roles.
And the proposed structure, where would it sit?
It suggests placing the cyber force within the Army, similar to how the Space Force was established within the Air Force. This allows it to leverage existing infrastructure and support systems while maintaining a distinct identity. The report also emphasizes a larger civilian workforce within this new service, recognizing the specialized, often non-military skill sets required for cyber warfare. It also highlights the critical role of the National Guard and Reserve, integrating part-time cyber talent from the private sector.
And implementation. How fast could this happen?
They suggest a phased approach, beginning with initial planning, followed by a two-year foundation-building phase focused on establishing the organizational structure, personnel policies, specialized training, dedicated R&D, and a distinct cyber culture. This is a massive undertaking, but one the report argues is essential for U.S. cyber superiority in the long run.
In a related development also on September 9th, the Department of the Air Force released its Network of the Future strategy. Sounds important.
It is. This strategy details ambitious plans for a resilient and adaptive encrypted network, It calls for a unified, integrated digital infrastructure across the Air Force, balancing robust security with necessary operational flexibility. It also emphasizes significant investments in artificial intelligence for network management and defense, edge computing to process data closer to its source, 5G communications for high-speed, low-latency connectivity, and advanced cybersecurity measures.
The ultimate goal.
To provide warfighters with critical data anywhere, anytime, ensuring seamless connectivity and rapid decision-making across all domains, air, space, and cyber. A true interconnected battle network. That's the vision.
Moving now to global conflict, a major and highly sensitive development occurred on September 10th concerning Israel and Qatar. This had significant and immediate U.S. reactions that highlighted the delicate balance of interests in the Middle East.
Yeah, this event was highly sensitive and had immediate regional and diplomatic implications. Israel launched an assassination strike against Hamas's political leadership located in Qatar. This action appeared to immediately end ongoing efforts for hostage release negotiations, which Qatar had been mediating, and drew widespread condemnation across the region.
And the U.S. response, carefully worded, I imagine.
Very. It highlighted the administration's dismay. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt stated that President Trump was dismayed by the location of the strike happening in the territory of Qatar, a key U.S. ally and host of a major American airbase. That's the crucial point. Trump believed the strike was not in the U.S.'s interests, adding that he feels very bad about the location, emphasizing the diplomatic fallout. The administration was notified as the attack was happening, suggesting they were not consulted or given prior approval.
What about Qatar?
Qatar, for its part, quickly and strongly accused Israel of violating international norms and laws, stating the strike threatened the security and safety of Qataris and residents, and calling it an act of aggression. Understandable reaction.
Hamas claimed its top negotiators survived the strike, but confirmed that five of its members and one Qatari internal security force member were killed in the operation. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's office stated it was a wholly independent operation aimed at eliminating terrorist leadership.
The political divide in the U.S. was immediately clear, wasn't it? Republicans like Senators James E. Risch and Roger Wicker offered strong support for Israel's right to defend itself.
While Democrats like Rebecca McCollum and Senator Reid condemned the strike, warning it diminishes the prospects of returning the remaining hostages and severely harms peace efforts in the region. This single event just fractured an already fragile diplomatic landscape.
Deeply. Finally, we have new and, frankly, disturbing details emerging on September 10th of the Trump administration's deal with El Salvador regarding migrants. This shines a light on a highly controversial aspect of immigration enforcement.
What are the new details?
Documents from a Democracy Forward lawsuit revealed a shocking detail. The Trump administration explicitly barred U.S. funds from being used to provide legal counsel to hundreds of Venezuelan men who were sent to El Salvador's notorious CECOT megaprison.
CECOT, remind us.
For you as a listener, CECOT is El Salvador's highly publicized and controversial maximum security prison. It's known for its extremely harsh conditions and credible allegations of torture and human rights abuses against its inmates. The five-page agreement the U.S. had with El Salvador placed no conditions on the treatment or care of individuals in custody, a stark omission, but it explicitly forbade funds for legal counseling, denying legal help.
And the administration had sent approximately 200 Venezuelan men to CECOT with plans for up to 300 and paid El Salvador $4.76 million for this arrangement.
That's right. This goes back to President Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act back in March to deport alleged Tren de Aragua gang members without trial, bypassing normal due process. Legal challenges have largely frowned upon this expansive use of the act, which is typically reserved for wartime situations involving enemy nationals.
And many of the Venezuelan men sent to CECOT, according to reports, were actually asylum seekers and economic migrants, often without criminal history.
Correct. They were eventually returned to Venezuela in July after about 4 months in CECOT, highlighting a highly criticized and legally dubious chapter in U.S. immigration policy. A dark chapter.
Okay, let's wrap up our deep dive with a look at some final judicial and legislative updates. These reveal ongoing battles over political representation and the broader societal implications of federal policy. Lots still happening.
Yeah, this section truly covers the diverse legal battles and policy debates that further color the federal landscape, from how states draw their political maps to the future of the American workforce itself.
On September 10th, the Missouri State House approved a new GOP-friendly congressional district map by a 90-65 vote.
And this map is specifically designed to net Republicans an additional U.S. House seat, potentially shifting the balance of power in Congress. This plan now heads to the state Senate.
And Governor Mike Kehoe called a special session specifically for this mid-decade map redrawing. That's unusual.
It is. A politically charged maneuver, clearly timed. And this is just one of several ongoing redistricting battles across the country, highlighting the intense partisan fight for political power through map drawing.
States like Texas, Louisiana, North Dakota, Mississippi, and Utah all face significant legal challenges over their congressional or state legislative maps. And these have major implications for the Voting Rights Act and even who can bring such lawsuits, right?
Exactly. In Texas, for instance, lawsuits have been filed over new House lines, arguing they violate the Voting Rights Act and the 14th Amendment by discriminating against Latino voters. A preliminary injunction hearing is scheduled for early October. This is a crucial fight over minority representation.
And Louisiana's congressional map, which was previously ordered by a lower court to include a second majority Black House district, is going through the unusual step of a Supreme Court rehearing.
Yes, the state is pressing the high court to oppose race-based redistricting, arguing against the necessity of creating such districts to ensure minority representation, a direct challenge to established precedent.
And North Dakota and Mississippi both face Supreme Court appeals regarding a fundamental question. Whether Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits racial discrimination in voting, is privately enforceable, can citizens sue under it?
Right. Lower courts have issued conflicting rulings on this. North Dakota found only the Justice Department can enforce it, while Mississippi confirmed private standing to sue. This sets up a potentially landmark Supreme Court decision on the future power of the Voting Rights Act itself. Huge implications.
And in Utah, a state judge ordered lawmakers to redraw congressional lines according to a 2018 ballot initiative that created an independent redistricting commission, a citizen-led effort to remove partisan gerrymandering.
Right. This ruling overturned a previous GOP legislative repeal of that initiative, asserting the will of the voters over legislative attempts to reassert partisan control. So these battles are happening everywhere, with major implications for voting rights, political representation, and the very structure of democracy across the country. Really fundamental stuff.
On the education front, something equally significant was released. The first results of the National Assessment of Education Progress, or NAEP, since before the COVID-19 pandemic. Released on September 10th, what did they show?
The news wasn't good. These scores show that 12th grade students achieved their lowest reading and math scores in decades. It signals a worrying decline in educational attainment and raises serious questions about the long-term impact of pandemic-era learning disruptions. A real challenge for educators and policymakers.
Turning now to broader legislative and political debates, an opinion piece by Gleb Sapirsky on September 10th highlighted a critical and growing issue: the impact of the administration's AI action plan on worker displacement.
Yes, Sapirsky argues that AI systems are already demonstrably displacing entry-level jobs, particularly in fields like software development, customer service, and data analysis. Not just future threat, but current impact. He cites data showing employment for 22, 25-year-olds falling significantly in these AI-exposed fields, indicating a systemic shift rather than just anecdotal job losses.
And he contends that the Trump administration's AI action plan, which focuses primarily on accelerating AI deployment and fostering technological leadership, needs a robust safety net for the workforce.
Exactly. He argues it needs large-scale, accessible job retraining programs and potentially a basic income floor to prevent further worker displacement from spiraling into a social crisis. Sapirsky suggests employer-validated short-cycle programs, wage-linked supports during training, and time-limited basic income pilots specifically targeted at early career workers to help them transition into new roles in an AI-driven economy. It's a proactive call to address the social consequences of technological advancement before it's too late.
On September 10th, the debate over President Trump's third-term comments continued to generate discussion, even reaching the Supreme Court.
Well, indirectly. Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett publicly confirmed that the 22nd Amendment to the U.S. Constitution unequivocally prevents a president from serving more than two terms, clarifying the established legal precedent. Justice Sonia Sotomayor agreed it is settled law, but noted quite pointedly that no one has ever actually challenged it in court, which is an interesting observation.
President Trump and his allies have repeatedly floated the idea of a third term, sometimes framing it as a joke, other times appearing more serious, which continues to stir political speculation and requires these kinds of clarifications from judicial figures.
Keeps the issue alive, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Also on September 10th, Paramount appointed Kenneth Weinstein, a former Trump nominee, to the U.S. Office of Personnel Management as ombudsman for CBS News.
An ombudsman? That sounds like an internal watchdog role. Why is this significant?
It's significant because this appointment was part of the intricate conditions required to clear the multi-billion-dollar merger of Paramount with Skydance through President Trump's Federal Communications Commission, or FCC. It raises immediate concerns about media independence and potential political influence over news organizations.
And Paramount also recently paid $16 million to Trump's foundation to settle a lawsuit. Adds another layer.
It certainly adds to the perception of influence. Trump and his allies have previously, and often vehemently, attacked CBS News coverage, accusing it of bias. Furthermore, his FCC chair has signaled a willingness to scrutinize the network's broadcast license, a powerful regulatory threat. So, the appointment of a former Trump nominee as an ombudsman, a position typically meant to ensure journalistic ethics and accuracy under these circumstances, creates a climate where critics argue political considerations could influence news coverage. It raises serious questions about the independence and integrity of major media outlets.
Finally, Representative Ayanna Pressley, a Democrat from Massachusetts, wrote to Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell on September 10th. What was her concern?
She urged him to address the alarming rise in unemployment among Black women. August data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed unemployment for Black women at 2.4 percentage points higher than the national average, a significant disparity.
And she linked this directly to?
She explicitly attributed this rise to mass federal workforce layoffs by the current Trump administration. She noted that these layoffs disproportionately impacted Black women, who comprise 12% of the federal workforce, a higher percentage than their 7% representation in the overall U.S. workforce.
So the firings hit this group harder.
That's the argument. The Washington-based Fiscal Policy Institute reported that D.C.'s Black unemployment soared to 9.9% in the first quarter of 2025 due to these firings. This led D.C.'s chief financial officer, Glenn Lee, to anticipate a mild recession in 2026 and a significant $1 billion revenue decrease for the city over the next 3 years. It highlights the direct, tangible impact of federal workforce policy on specific demographic groups and local economies. These aren't just abstract numbers. #outro. What's truly fascinating here as we reflect on the sheer breadth of federal activity these past 48 hours is the often stark internal contradictions, isn't it? We've seen an administration simultaneously pushing a disruptive domestic agenda from redefining healthcare regulation and streamlining government contracting, yet expanding its internal surveillance capabilities through initiatives like Do Not Pay. It's a complex, multi-layered approach to governance, hard to pin down sometimes.
And on the global stage, we observe the U.S. navigating a landscape very much shaped by its own domestic policies. That led to friction and diplomatic crises with key allies like South Korea. This occurs even while reinforcing partnerships elsewhere and managing rivalries, like with China. The tension between America First domestic priorities and long-term geopolitical objectives is truly a central thread through all of this. It creates a challenging environment for both allies and rivals to predict U.S. behavior.
Which really raises an important question for you, our listener. In a world of such rapid, often seemingly contradictory policy shifts, how do we, as informed citizens, discern the true strategic direction amidst daily headlines and the evolving narratives? How do we differentiate between tactical maneuvers and fundamental shifts in governance? It's tough.
Consider this. When the federal government acts in ways that are simultaneously pro-business in deregulation but pro-state in surveillance, or when it incentivizes critical supply chains while simultaneously punishing the very allies making those investments, what does that signal about the predictability and reliability of governance, both at home and abroad, in the years to come? Will this create an environment of agile efficiency or one of profound uncertainty? What's the long-term cost?
It's a lot to mull over. Definitely, and certainly a lot more to explore as these stories continue to unfold day by day. We hope this deep dive has given you some valuable insights into the incredibly busy and complex federal landscape of the past 2 days.